I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast where we talk about issues in medicine and agriculture with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things it can do for people and the planet. I'm Kevin Folta, and today we're going to do our year in review. It's our original idea, right? We have today the other host of Talking Biotech, Paul Vincelli. Paul, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. It's really good to be talking to you, Kevin. We hear each other a lot over the podcast, but actually don't talk very much. So it's great to be able to close out the year with you this time.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it was so much fun when we got to get together in Guelph this year.
Yeah, yes.
Like it's always fun when you have a lot of interaction with somebody, and you know, like Paul's a huge contributor to this really important podcast that both of us really are excited to do. Yet Paul and I never met in person until June of 2017.
That's right. Yeah, we've had quite a bit of interaction digitally until then. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. So. But the idea of today was, we thought, well, wouldn't it be a great idea to be able to sit back and think about the last year, plan for next year, and share some of our thoughts with the listeners? And one of the big areas that's particularly exciting has been the growth of the podcast. And at the beginning of the year, I think we're talking about maybe 1,500, 2,000 downloads a week. And now we're looking at somewhere around 6,000 downloads a week.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really wonderful for there to be that much growth. And you and I are both excited about that. We're glad to know. I think we can say we're glad to know that people appreciate the program. Well, I think you and I have a bit of an amusement about it. It's done by the scientists. There's no audio engineering, you know, beyond what Kevin does. But we're scientists. We're not professional, radio people and all that. So it's kind of fun, and I think our listeners are generally tolerant of our goof ups, and we have fun with it. So.
Yeah, that was one of the comments I got this year, is that one of the things they really enjoy about the podcast is that it's not very professional.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's like the old Complisalt, you know.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, but that's but the main idea is that what happens here is that that's the main idea of what does happen here. This is two scientists who enjoy talking to people in the public, communicating with people, using the most efficient medium to do that. And this has been a really great experience that I could have never have predicted. And Paul, you've been a wonderful addition. This has been a great thing.
It's been my pleasure, Kevin, really.
If we look back on this year, in this particular, in 2017, mm-hmm. and we examine the list that of episodes that we've done. I mean, I look at it, and I'm just amazed at how many hours and how many people we've spoken to. But yeah. Is there anything that really stands out in your mind as an interview that you really enjoyed?
Well, yeah, there are about five or six that popped out, and maybe I'll get a chance to mention all of them on this program, or maybe not. But I would say one of mine and one of yours, you know, just jump right out. And the one of mine is the one with Carol Mallory Smith from Oregon State University. She's a weed scientist and really was the one in the public arena, at least, that documented a valid case of the flow of transgenes from the engineered crop into well, the engineered crop into the wild. In her case, it was transgene flow was occurring by a seed movement, principally, if not, as I recall that episode. And I think what's important about that episode is just to remind listeners, if they're not familiar with the phrase or the term transgene, that refers to an engineered gene that comes from outside the breeding pool. And so the crop she was working with was creeping bentgrass experimentally that had been engineered for glyphosate tolerance. And she did document that the spread of that genetic trait had occurred beyond what was designated to be the control area for that experimental creeping bentgrass. What I think is important about that, Kevin, and we've talked about this, you and I, is it was an example where we actually explored the concerns of at least some genetically engineered crops, and that is the movement of genes that are transgenes originally outside the breeding pool. There were no, as far as I know, ecological impacts documented. But there are concerns about the flow of transgenes in creeping bentgrass, and especially as it might impact seed growers. And we put it on the program. So we're not sort of an echo chamber, I think was the phrase you used when you and I talked about this episode.
Now, it's a really important point, is that it's been said online and in various places that this is simply just another tool that is a PR arm of the agrochemical industry, Fulta getting money under the table to do the podcast, which is really what's so hilarious about it. In general, people have stayed away from the podcast, and so they'll go on Twitter and say stuff or whatever, Facebook, other places, but they kind of left the podcast alone. They don't really go adding stuff to, like, the comments sections have been reasonably immune.
And that's good to hear.
Yeah, I think so. There's been a couple, but that's should be expected, I think. Some people just don't know better, and they don't understand, and so they come there to try to understand. So maybe those are just honestly concerned people who've been misdirected.
Mm-hmm. But you had a program that I think you may want to mention here in this. But another example of this, how we do what we talk about what we think is important to talk about in this podcast series, and the dicamba situation. I mean, that was a perfect example of how, you in this case talked about a very touchy issue, a controversial issue that involves major seed companies and chemical manufacturers, and not in a flattering way necessarily.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, I always am excited to talk about this one because it was something that really has, and what was most amazing thing to me was that when I was at this conference in St. Louis, that they were talking about the implications of the dicamba situation, which is where this herbicide that they apply in some cases, because of various factors that may be because of the inherent properties of the chemical or because of the way it's applied, can literally lift up out of the field in a vapor cloud of doom and go somewhere else and drop down into the field. And if that field is conventional soybeans that don't have the transgene, or glyphosate resistant soybeans that don't have the dicamba resistance, or if it's a vineyard or a peach orchard or whatever, that stuff shows symptoms of dicamba injury, which can do it at 1/20,000th of its application rate. And one of the things I thought was so amazing was that the so much finger pointing from the industry and from farmers and people really not happy with the academics who would say, hey, here's what I can see and here's what I think. And what are the implications on a bigger scale here? Because what it shows is, wow, here's an unintended consequence. And this is what people who are against this technology fervently digging their heels about and say, this is what it is. So here's an example where they were right. And the companies don't realize the problem that causes, because now it makes everybody's job harder in explaining how this technology can work. And it's a way in which a consequence of applying an herbicide in Missouri now may very well stop a vitamin-enriched banana from saving someone's vision in Uganda.
What a great connection. You know, I think for the listeners' benefit, I want to say this as clearly as I can. You know, there's never any discussion between you and me or emails or anything that raise the question, oh, but what will the companies think? We don't consider that. We just present the best science we can on issues that we think are important to cover. And so I wanted to say that as clearly as I can. Now, you've made a very interesting connection here, and that is the unintended consequences of the dicamba situation can certainly be used by those who are skeptical of genetic engineering. This situation can be used to pile on and criticize the technology used to create the herbicide tolerant crop. And it couldn't be any clearer in my opinion as well. I'm like you, very aware of many of the public projects that are using genetic engineering in developing countries. You've done some wonderful programs on these, where these are traits that can help developing countries meet their food security and food sovereignty goals. Projects that have smallholder farmers and smallholder farm families in mind, and people might say, "But yeah, but what's the connection between Uganda and corn in the United States?" You know, and the connection is in developing countries, they look to see public reaction to these new technologies. And if public reaction is negative, whether or not that is justifiable from the standpoint of the developing countries, they see Europeans, they see some Americans reject the technology, and they think, oh, we should too, you know. And so I'm glad you brought that up, because that is, for me, one of the deep motivating factors to talk about the technology, is to make sure that those countries that that might have a public use for it, that is, you know, it's a perfectly public project. It's not anything to do with Monsanto or Bayer or Syngenta or any other major corporation. And you know, and I'd like to see them use it if they think it fits for them in meeting their food sovereignty goals.
Yeah, I mean, that's really important. Hate the companies, I don't care. You know, but but if you really hate the company, try to be specific with your angst and and try to, you know, and they always say, you know, go march against Monsanto, whatever, I don't care. What it really is about is, don't malign a technology that can help people, because this is where being there in Uganda, and those episodes were maybe 104, 105, 106, those were amazing episodes to me, because it was an opportunity to actually talk about what I was standing in and seeing the potential need and seeing the potential application, both existing. And you have need and application separated by an 8-foot barbed wire fence with razor wire on it.
Yeah.
And if you think about how that affects, you know, a scientist, I mean, you can imagine, you know how that would affect you, certainly. But I guess the listener has to kind of get in my head is, you know, here I am getting into this idea, this business, but also, you know, or into academic science, I should say. I say this business colloquially. In academic science, with the idea of creating durable changes that can help people, and seeing beautiful work being done, that's not my work. I see amazing stuff that other people are doing. And seeing it kind of dead on arrival because of a public opinion crisis and a lack of a freedom to operate in food security and food sovereignty. It has nothing to do with companies. And that's really one of the things I've discovered about this podcast, is how it helps me articulate better that situation when you have need that is it just can't be met because of a public opinion thing. So if you and I can change the minds or influence the decisions of a few dozen people a year, maybe a few hundred, a few thousand, that's a big step in the right direction, because, you know, the Institute for Responsible Technology and Food Inc. and all that stuff, that's always there, and it's great for us to push back and push back honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there was another program that that you know, I think I was rather proud of as well, or another podcast in this series this past year, and that was on that was number 111 on seed company consolidation, and we had Dr. Sylvie Bonny from INRA in France speak on I think the title of her paper actually that she was focusing on was corporate concentration and technological change in the global seed industry, and so, you know, again, that was a case where we used the podcast to explore a criticism of genetic engineering, and that is that you know, it leads to this corporate consolidation of economic influence with respect to seed, you know, the seeds and even other chemical inputs and so on, and you know, it's a valid point, it's a valid concern. We explore it in my graduate course on genetic engineering. In fact, we in my graduate course series on genetic engineering, it's a 1 credit each semester online course. That in that course, we actually spend more time discussing the concerns and risks of genetic engineering and exploring those than we do on the benefits. Just because I think our public, as public scientists, that's a responsibility we have to do our very best to evaluate the downsides of technology as well as the benefits. And so, again, there we were, episode 111 on the podcast series, looking at the corporate concentration question. And I think actually Dr. Bonny did a great job of really sort of bringing both sides of the issue to the podcast, and it's also described in her paper.
Yeah, maybe the other one that falls into that particular bin was John Tooker. And Dr. John Tooker's at Penn State, and I met him years ago and have followed his work, and he always has very precautionary, not on purpose, I don't think, but he describes very well the kind of unanticipated off-target effects of this technology. And he talked about how BT, when you kill all the BT beetles, how the things that beetles might eat or interact with in that ecological context now become problematic, and how BT that would kill beetles now has caused an outbreak of slugs. So that was another good one that really says, you know, here's that, you know, there, nothing happens in a vacuum. We're all part of an ecology and all part of a bigger question. And that's another one that, and he's got more too. So I have to get him on again in 2018.
Great. Yeah, that'd be a good one. Yeah, cool.
So one of the other big changes we had this last year were guest hosts and other folks who came on aside from you and me. We think back to episode 102, which was Lauren Benoit and Sarah Shepard. Lauren has been a friend and someone who has stepped into the conversation, and I hope to see both of them a whole bunch more. But we also had episode 91, which was Chris Barbie, who's actually my graduate student.
Yeah, who, I remember.
It
was nice.
Well, it was nice, and the best part about that one is he had our most high-profile guest probably of the year with Rich Roberts, who Sir Richard Roberts, who is a Nobel Prize winner.
Yeah, so stardom, jump into the deep end, you know.
Yeah, and that's you know, you and I did that little bridge for the middle of the episode about, you know, more people getting involved. And then we also had Dr. Johnny Dalzell, and he contacted me from Northern Ireland and said, you know, hey, can I do a podcast? Can I host one?
Yeah.
And it came out nicely, too. So more of that in 2018.
Good, yeah. Yeah, yeah. In fact, so I give you a lot of credit for bringing in Chris and other guest hosts. It's really, I think you're absolutely on target to want to expand the involvement of people who want to give it a try. And so, listeners, I think Kevin is quite sincere about that. And you know, if you want to give it a try, doing a podcast episode on your own or in some portion, contact Kevin.
Yeah, and we can do a lot of work in post-production, and it's pretty amazing. One of the ones coming up, I spent probably a good 6 hours just correcting it to make it, we'll talk about it maybe a little bit later, but it actually was a live recording, and I guess we always record them live, right? We're not exactly... It was done in a busy place, side by side with the guests, and between their voices and fading in and out in the background, it was a challenge. It had a motorcycle that's sitting out in front of the place, idling, and so long story short, it can take time, but we can make anyone sound fantastic, except for me. Yeah. It's like I get a new voice. Are there any other episodes that really stood out in your mind, the things that you really were proud of, or interviews that you really find memorable?
Absolutely. For sure. Thanks for the opportunity to mention the episode on restoring the American chestnut. We had Dr. Jared Westbrook from the American Chestnut Foundation as our guest, and he's the director of science, so he is the leader on the breeding efforts to create American chestnuts that look like American chestnuts, but are relatively resistant to chestnut blight. He's not doing genetic engineering. He's using conventional breeding with Chinese chestnut as his source of resistance genes. And so you had an episode, I believe 10, Kevin, Dr. William Powell, who's doing work with a transgene placed into the American chestnut, and the gene is from wheat. It's an oxidase.
Yeah, easy for you to say.
Not so much. And so he has found that this single gene from wheat confers a rather high degree of resistance in American chestnut. But it's a genetic engineering approach. And what I loved about Dr. Westbrook's program was that he didn't see these as Dr. William Powell's approach with the transgenic approach from wheat. He didn't see that as threatening in any way to his program. In fact, he used the word complementary, or one of us did somewhere in the program, and he affirmed it. So in other words, he as a conventional breeder sees great value in the genetic engineering approach to be used in tandem with ultimately with the conventional breeding approach that he's taken. And so I really appreciated his attitude, haven't forgotten it. So.
Yeah, what's really nice about that is that two things. One is that breeding chestnut trees has got to be one of the most ambitious jobs, because how many genetic cycles can you get in a career? When you think about it, right? Because that takes a few years for that thing to flower. So, you're not going to make a cross until 2023. And so that really amazes me. And the other cool thing is that, Jared used to be in my molecular biology class. I actually was his professor.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yeah. So that's kind of cool. He was always a really sharp guy when he was in our program. And it's awesome to see him land on his feet. And it's really fun that you scheduled that. I didn't say, hey, you should talk to Jared Westbrook. You arranged that, and I thought, oh, Jared, hey, I know that guy.
And he also said something that surprised me. It makes perfect sense, but it's kind of the contrary of what we normally think in this area of genetic engineering. Normally, we try to pay a lot of attention to the issue of transgene flow, as I mentioned earlier. And he actually said, we want transgene flow, or he said we want outcrossing. So if there ever is a day, which may be, who knows, in the next decade, where the genetic engineering trait for American chestnut resistance to the blight is introduced, then he wants that trait to be outcrossed through pollen flow into as many American chestnut trees as possible to try to put that gene through natural gene flow into as wide a genetic base as possible. So he actually wants transgene flow, in contrast to the situation in Oregon, where the seed growers are very nervous about the transgene flow and creeping bentgrass, and rightfully so. But in the American chestnut, they're looking forward to natural outcrossing through and the subsequent transgene flow.
And I think if I had a favorite episode of the year, it had to be number 77, and that was sitting with Dr. Dwayne Mitchell. And the idea of cancer immunotherapy, especially with these targeted engineered viruses that go after things like glioblastoma, these insidious brain diseases that were previously more or less a death sentence or profound therapy, or really invasive therapies. These new methods seem to be working in a lot of cases, and what they're doing is using genetic engineering to turn viruses into sentries that go in and actually attack the cells and destroy them. And Dr. Mitchell is really amazing. Dr. Mitchell's here at University of Florida. Is one of these cases where I got to walk across campus and talk across a desk with somebody. Yeah. And, when I was going into the door, I was really hesitant because I thought, here's this guy who's the leader of this brain institute, and he's, but he was the nicest guy I ever met, and not just really nice and accommodating. He was an outstanding guest, and his ability to communicate the science. So he had all of the above. He had outstanding science and a really exciting science, but a beautiful way to communicate it. And if anyone ever is looking for, well, which one should I listen to, I really recommend episode 77. Dr. Yeah. Mitchell was an all-star, and I really hope to get him back on in 2018.
Yeah, you definitely trend towards bringing in the medical applications, which is an area I don't have enough experience with. When I was at a conference in Berkeley, California, this past August, it was a wonderful conference on CRISPR potential and concerns, and I met Mr. Shakir Cannon, and he is an African American who is the co-founder of Minority Coalition for Precision Medicine, and he's about, I'd say, in his early 30s, and he's and that's important, and as you'll see in a minute, he's an advocate and an activist for the use of the most advanced medical technologies for minorities, as well as for those of us who are populate the larger racial classes. And he's at one point in the program, he's, as a speaker, he turned to some of the researchers and he said, "Hurry up." He said, "Hurry up. He went on to describe that he was a sickle cell anemia patient. And so for him, this is very personal, that the use of CRISPR technologies as an example might be the fastest path to a full, long and full life for him, and a life without the pain that he often experiences as a patient of this disease. So, the medical world is chock full of genetic engineering applications. So it's great that you bring those into the podcast, Kevin.
Hi, everybody, and thanks for listening to the podcast. In episode 118, we tried something new. First, live streaming the podcast on Facebook Live while recording the final product for the podcast. This all goes live on January 20th, with the live stream already online. I talked about pet vaccination and pet food with two outstanding veterinarians, and it was a great conversation. The advantage of doing it live is that we can take questions in real time. And the next live stream will be on January 7th, 2018, from the American Farm Bureau meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, I don't know the topic, I don't know the guest, but there's many notables at this meeting, and it promises to be a lot of fun. So watch the Talking Biotech Twitter feed, and watch my professional Facebook page, which is facebook.com/KMFolta, on January 6th. Details will be provided at that time. It's really a lot of fun to field the questions on the fly, and it's great to enjoy another level of active engagement with this audience. It's another way to say thank you and add another new dimension as this audience continues to grow. Now back to the podcast. Yeah, I think in 2018 we're going to talk about some of the hybrid receptors that have been designed especially against bloodborne disease. When you talk about issues like sickle cell and issues like leukemia, you actually do have a target that is resident where you can actually do the real therapy. You can't replace somebody's brain or somebody's liver without a transplant, but you can do significant change in blood because you can add new stem cells that have been reprogrammed to take on a job. And some of the more interesting things have come from CRISPR-Cas9, or I should just say gene editing of of antigenic markers off of cell surfaces to create a generic cell type that can now be modified with a receptor that can precisely find a protein on a white blood cell that is gone malignant. So it allows scientists to create these very precise target, very precise tools that can attack the cancer and are not immunologically reactive. So you're not triggering the immune response in the patient while they're getting the therapy. And it's a huge step forward, and a place where there are children alive today walking on the face of this planet who are alive because of this technology. And we're going to do a whole lot more of that in 2018.
Wonderful. Yeah, I look forward to it. Yeah, you mentioned you started the discussion on kind of where we might be going here in the next year in the podcast. And there are a couple things that certainly I've given some thought to. And one is actually at the request of a listener, we're going to have a couple, like a two-part series. I arranged for Fred Gould to talk about gene drives. Fred is an entomologist from NC State, the North Carolina State University, and has a great knowledge on gene drives, but is distant enough that I think we can count on a very objective evaluation of the biology of gene drives. And if you don't know what gene drives are, it is a I don't know how to say it in a sentence, I guess, but it's a genetic trait that actually occurs in nature that has non-Mendelian inheritance and actually is inherited more rapidly than the normal 50% of genes that are inherited normally, and also included in that. So Fred is going to talk about the biology of gene drives, and Jennifer Kuzma has been suggested. She's Fred's colleague, so I think Fred can maybe half volunteer her. Jennifer Kuzma from North Carolina State will participate as well, hopefully as a guest, and she is, I believe, the director of the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at NC State University. So I'm going to ask her to bring in consideration of the social and ethical questions that surround gene drives. So, yeah, that's one of the things I'd hope to do next year.
Now, that's really exciting because she'll be a good person to talk to on these things. She brings to light a lot of the sociological edges of these issues. The people I'm excited to talk to, I got a couple that I'm really stoked about. I want to talk to Jennifer Raff, and Dr. Raff is a genetic anthropologist or genomic anthropologist out of Kansas. Oh no, K-State. Yeah, no, not the one in Manhattan. The other one. University of Kansas in Lawrence. I'm sorry. You know, and I cringe every time someone goes Florida State University of Florida, which was which. You know, but she's from University of Kansas, and she's fantastic. And she's been on the PRISM podcast, which is one of my favorite podcasts with Grant Ritchie. She does a great job at talking about what is race. And is this concept of race really supported, or at least the buckets that we put people into, is it really supported by genetics? And what you find is that there are more genetic differences that group us than there are phenotypic differences that group us. And so our races really are rather ethereal relative to the hardwired blueprints that we all carry. Yeah. And the other one is one that I recorded a few years ago, probably back in the first year I did the podcast, was Dr. Harry Paris. And Dr. Harry Paris talked about the domestication of pumpkins. And I always wanted it for a Halloween episode. But Dr. Paris, I talked to him from Israel, where he was, and we had a connection that as he would speak, you would hear kind of this increasing in the background, and it would start out kind of quiet, and then as he would go on, it would get louder and louder and louder, and it just became, I could not clean that out. And it was a beautiful interview that talked about some of the cool parts about pumpkin domestication, where early domesticators used to carry it like beef jerky. Like, you'd make pumpkin jerky by drying the pumpkin guts out in the sun, and you'd eat that. And it sounds kind of horrific for Halloween, but there are some very interesting stories about where these things were domesticated and how they radiated throughout the world.
Yeah. One of the ones that's kind of on my to-do list here is for the upcoming year is transposons, jumping genes, and honestly, they just fascinate me that there are these, for lack of a better term, genetic parasites that are quite common in plants. We rightfully ask a lot of questions about stability of genetically engineered traits and the mobility of such. You know, I think these are important questions. And out there in nature, we've got this stuff going on, just wild and crazy genetic changes. Jumping genes. I mean, and so I'm looking forward to having at least one guest come on the podcast and explain what these are. I know, Kevin, somebody with your background probably has long-standing knowledge about these things, but I've just been fascinated by them and look forward to having at least one guest tell us what they are and, you know, what they do.
No, that's a great idea. I know that there's that it really does help let the air out of the balloon a lot of the concerns that people express about genetic engineering, such as, well, what if the gene you introduce drops right in the middle of something else? To me, that's not a concern, because in a genome where 75% of it, like corn, is transposable elements and other stuff, many times mobile elements. We know of many examples of plant genes that have come about and plant traits that have come about, such as the round shape versus oval shape of tomatoes, is controlled because of a piece of DNA that got up from one part in the genome, jumped out of the chromosome, and then sat down someplace else. And the resulting fruit was funny shaped. That's work done by Esther Vandernap, and she was at Ohio State, now at University of Georgia. And she does fantastic work, and she may be a really good interview on tomatoes, but could be somebody who could at least touch on some of the ramifications of a jumping gene.
Yeah, well, that's a great idea. I didn't understand just how wild and crazy nature is with genetics in the world we live in. I didn't understand that until. I got into this topic and, studied not only genetic engineering in depth, but also related subjects like jumping genes and horizontal gene transfer and all these other crazy things that nature does with genes. And I agree, the more I study nature and the more I study conventional breeding, the more I realize that genetic engineering is really just part of the mix here. It's not anything, intrinsically distinct. And I know some listeners may have some questions about that or challenges, but it really it's just another way of moving chemical information and, in a targeted way, actually. So I think, I could make a pretty good argument that the wild and crazy and uncontrolled things that nature does really could pose a greater risk than genetic engineering. So it's food for thought, something to think about.
That's very true. And I think if you go back, and that's another thing that more, I'd like to have more of these episodes on. You know, plant domestication is kind of my hobby. Uh-huh. some some guys who are in their 50s, have other hobbies, things that they do. They travel.
Do woodworking.
maybe build ships and bottles or something. My interest is to read about domestication and when. Nice. What are the things that humans did accidentally to bring plants into their care? And some of the things that are so exciting and some of the things I love to talk about are the genomics and genetic basis of those traits, major traits. Things like seed shattering, that one of the domestication traits that you see, and I love these stories, where in sorghum in Africa, sorghum was domesticated in at least three different places because it was a really important crop. Maybe in West Africa, East Africa, and South Africa. And Southern Africa on the continent. And when you use molecular biology to go back and look at these land races that people would save and cultivate, you find that one of the same traits they have is that they all retain the seeds on the seed head. They don't just fall off, which is, you know, a trait that you'd obviously want. It turns out that all three major land races have mutations in exactly the same gene, but different mutations.
Different mutations.
So three separate groups of people, or three different breeders, for lack of a better term, selected the same trait with mutations in the same gene. Three different genetic engineers who made the same sort of genetic engineering change just by breeding and selection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what's interesting, you know, many nuances in everything we talk about on the podcast, including the domestication issue. And so one of the things that I hear in what you just said is, you know, you're sort of normalizing mutation. For biologists, maybe we sort of take it for granted that everybody understands that mutation is can be good or it can be bad. You know, it really depends on the mutation
or neither.
Where it is. Or neither. It can be neutral. And so, you know, the cases of domestication all depended, as you described, on a mutation that, because of the humans that found it useful, that mutation, they went on to select those mutants. And so, you know, that's a point that sometimes comes up in a, you know, public talk is for me to make sure people understand that mutation isn't bad, it isn't good, it may be neutral, but it is. It just is. And it's just in the context that, you know, that becomes useful or harmful. And that's true across the board, whether it's genetic engineering or any other process that leads to a new genetic trait.
Well, one of the other things that I really thought was great about the last year was we didn't strictly stick to the scientific interviews, that we did have some interviews where we brought in people to discuss either the communication side or potentially the media around the science. And so we go back to way back in January when I spoke to Jay Bayer, and I'm a huge fan of Jay. He wrote the book Hug Your Haters, and his interview was an excellent one to listen to learn how to be better at communicating with each other.
Sure.
And then
good stuff.
That was a good one. And then we also had interviews with two of the groups that have done documentaries. So episode 88 was an interview with Scott Hamilton Kennedy and Trey Sheehan with Alison Van Einenem. We talked about the movie Food Evolution and some of the criticism that came up, which was pretty sad, the criticism that was happening around what was a pretty good movie. And then No GMO, K-N-O-W, by Nick Syke. Nick's had this project going on for a few years. He's got some great vignettes online, but I talked to him on episode 86. And then we also had Science Moms, which was Natalie Newell. This was episode 113.
Recently.
Yeah, recently. And Natalie was, that was one of my favorite interviews of the year, too, because it was the amount of heat online that they get. So, and this is what's so amazing. Here you have Food Evolution, which is a factual, science-based film, and then some emotional edges that people in some places, like our University of California, Berkeley, wrote this long letter saying that this was propaganda, you know, from the
PR firms of the big companies, you know.
And the same thing happened with Science Moms. And here, it's great to see people creating science media and great to see that becoming influential, but it's still unfortunate that there are people out there who will take art and someone's hard work and someone's good work and trash it as being part of,
another leg of the agrochemical conspiracy.
You know, it just keeps coming up. So, yeah. And that's just an interesting dynamic of watching people create art in that space.
Yeah, I give you a lot of credit because I know in some of these instances you've reached out and invited critics. Maybe this is true for the Berkeley letter, but I think it is. But you've reached out to critics and said, "Look, come on the program, come on the podcast, let's have a conversation." And so far, I don't recall anyone accepting that. But that's I give you a lot of credit for making the offer.
So. No, I tried really hard, especially after that film came out and they were being so critical, because I also, you know, aside from being a scientist, I've also been very interested in communication, and I know what propaganda is, and I know how people use propaganda. That is not propaganda. And I wanted people to come on the podcast, and I wanted to talk to you know, the folks at Berkeley and the others around the country who signed on to that and said that this is propaganda. And I wanted to say, tell me what propaganda is. What is your definition of propaganda? Now, how does this meet that definition? And all of them were backed into a corner. They would not come on the podcast. I lost a lot of respect for some of these people who, you know, at least were very well regarded as scientists, but to dig in their heels as people who are going to take on this ideological mantle and run with it, even if it's not consistent with science. Mm-hmm. So that was, I do hope maybe they'll have a change of heart. They're always welcome on, as is anybody. I mean, I would be thrilled to talk to Seralini. I'd be thrilled to talk to anybody who feels this technology is inappropriate. I would say, you're welcome. Come talk to me and change my mind. Give me your evidence.
Yeah, good. Well done, Kevin. I really thank you for that attitude, and it just inspires me to continue to do the best job I can with these podcasts. So, I've covered the primary ones that I wanted to mention. There's many good podcasts out there from the year. Jonathan Jones, I worked with him and others. Listeners, take a look at the website and choose the ones you're interested in.
Yeah, you know, there were so many good ones that we didn't talk about today that I was really wanting to dive in with. There's the ones that I know that really moved me emotionally. I can think of those because, and people who know me know that I'm kind of easy to get me emotionally stirred, but particularly in this area, because of when I see technology that can help people that's paralyzed, it really bothers me a lot. But then after what I've endured personally because of the fact that I get out and talk about it, some of this stuff, which has really affected me in a really bad way. But to be able to, see people like Christine Latton, Dr. Latton, who is the postdoc who was criticized because of her research and where PETA was on her, I wanted to help her find some relief by popularizing her case and the battles that she's up against. And that was episode 95. And I remember breaking down in the middle of that because I don't want anyone to go through what I went through.
I don't think it's breaking down. I think it's humanizing us. And I appreciate your willingness to share who you are on the podcast. And so we scientists are human, and it's easy for us to stay in the left brain. That's where we're paid to be. but we are humans, and I think anything we can do to humanize ourselves and let others see our humanity is actually strengthens our capacity as communicators.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the other place that happened was episode 105 when I was actually standing on the porch of a friend's home in Uganda, overseeing his banana farm, his garden, and we had a broken down truck and warm beer, and I had to be really far away in a short time, and basically to be in D.C. the next morning, and I basically thought, you know, this, and so I took out my phone and we had an interview, and to talk to him and listen to the passion of his voice saying, you know, the people of my country want solutions, and we have solutions we can't use. You know, it is so hard to be in that place and see that happening and listen to a man who, for the love of the people he's surrounded with and his country and his country's food security, wants technology that there was no way to implement. That was a tough moment, and that's another one that was on episode 105.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Thank you for sharing that.
So just to recap a couple, kind of rapid fire, a couple of the things that I would really like to point out to listeners. If you're new to the podcast and you're looking for something to try to build your understanding, I think there's two great episodes from the last year, episode 74 and recent episode 114, which deal with ways in which RNAi technology, or this small RNA technology, is being used to combat the problem of aflatoxin.
Yes.
And aflatoxin in corn and peanut are massive problems. And that was one of the things I didn't appreciate. When I listened to it, and it was Monica Schmidt and Dilip Shah were the two who I spoke to. And it turns out that there are something like at least a billion people a year, or a billion people, not just a year, a billion people, who are chronically exposed to aflatoxin, one of the most potent carcinogens. And how,
and principally in the developing countries.
Yes, principally in developing countries. I think, Dr. Shah, when I spoke to him, I think he said 5 billion. And I guess that could be true. You know, in places like the U.S. and North America and Europe, you have very strict monitoring for this stuff and you don't get much exposure. But I guess I can imagine that can be right. But this is a very potent carcinogen that leads to liver cancer, and those are great ones to understand, because those are examples where this technology could go today and could be implemented, but is not.
Yeah, and in contrast to the general assumption that genetic engineering creates harmful plants, in fact, not only are they as safe as any other crops, genetic engineering, I know you know this, Kevin, but for the listeners, genetic engineering can be used to make crops safer. And the aflatoxin story is a really good one, really important. As a plant pathologist, I always go to that because in public talks, because if you want one or two things that really kind of override the concerns of that this is all about transnational corporations and all, you find you can talk about these cases in developing countries where developing country scientists are doing the work in their own way to address for them is a very important problem. And so those are excellent episodes on aflatoxin. Yeah.
So do you have anything already recorded for 2018, or are there other ones that you're planning to reach out to?
Actually, Allison Van Inningham, the marvelous animal scientist at the University of California, I believe at Davis,
yep.
She's recorded and so in the queue, along with some others I know you've got. But then I'm looking forward to doing episodes on gene drives and transposons. And I've got about a dozen topics I'd like to cover. We'll get to them all, but in their own time.
Well, I'll tease a few things here myself. Sure. I know that I have a couple in the box that are fantastic. I spoke with Dr. Maxine Thompson, and Dr. Maxine Thompson is a 91-year-old plant breeder. And she talked to me just about her excitement in plant breeding. The Hascap berry, and that one's coming up in January. But also, she talked about her challenges as being a woman in science back in the 1960s. Man, it's a very powerful episode.
Wonderful.
I had a great conversation with two veterinarians with about pet food and about pet vaccines, and just debunking myths. And it was we did it live. We had a great time together. That one's coming up too, and they're both friends here locally too. So it was a really, really good episode, and I'm going to do a whole lot more in the medical area. I would be excited to have other folks back on again who we've spoken to before. I think Allison Van Inningham, she was on. I think that was probably her fourth time on the podcast.
Yeah,
and
well, she's got that much to share. So
she's fantastic. Allison's my favorite person in terms of out speaking about science. I could watch her all day. The other things that are coming up, we're doing a live podcast from American Farm Bureau. That we actually the live stream. We're going to do a live feed of this, so you'll be able to watch it recorded live through Facebook, which will be over on my professional Facebook page at Facebook.com/KM Fulta. That'll be happening on the 7th of January. And so you'll be able to see the podcast recorded and then be able to listen to it later. And I don't know who the guest is yet or the guests are yet, but there but promises to be very exciting from the American Farm Bureau meeting in Nashville, Tennessee. And a whole lot more medical stuff. Like to go back, and we're going to continue the discussion of glyphosate. We're going to continue the discussion of dicamba and all the associated inputs with genetically engineered crops.
Wonderful. Yeah, it sounds great. I'm ready, you know, at the dial waiting to hear all these.
Yeah, and me too. I'm excited to be able to record them. And it's one of these things where people say, you know, how do you have time to do this? How do you have time to record these episodes? And I go, oh, record it. That's nothing. It's when you have to sit down and, you know, and edit and fit it into the, you know, intro and outro and develop a website. And popularize it on Twitter and using social media. It is seriously a 5-hour a week job, which doesn't sound like much, but when you're already working 110 hours a week.
You've got a research lab, and you're the chair of the Department of Horticulture at the University of Florida. So yeah, 5 hours to me seems like a lot, and I'm secretly glad that that has taken care for me, because it's a lot of work. So thanks for doing that. And I know you've said this on the program before, but others should hear and make sure they know it. This is something you do on a voluntary basis. There's no external funding and of any sort, either directly to you or to the University of Florida for this. This is just something you do out of your own hide, out of your own pocket. And so thanks for doing it.
Oh, thanks. You know, my pleasure. This is, you know, again, this is my ship in a bottle, right? And the idea of, you know, this is my midlife crisis. You know, some guys get a girlfriend or go buy a Porsche. I do a podcast. And the beauty part of this is that it is completely separate from my work, you know, at the university. And it's good to have that separation, you know, that you can... you know, and it makes sense, because my university work doesn't really deal with this particular topic, you know, directly per se. Anyway, I mean, I'm a scientist that has to understand what these things are, but for the most part, the people and the specifics are something that I study, you know, all the time. And the other really important part about this particular podcast is, I think in the next year we're going to try to do a lot more of that live streaming, try to do more with video that accompanies it, and try to take this thing that's doing well and actually make it bigger. And
sounds good.
And the idea of funding, they actually, I have been approached by advertisers that say that I could probably do something like $600 a month in income, which is, you know, that's not trivial. You're talking about $7,200 bucks a year for advertising and other types of support for the podcast. And I think, well, with $7,200 bucks a year, I could hire a producer, I could hire a website person, you know. But at the same time, I see the optics of having to have a commercial on for even something like 23andMe or whatever would be, there's people who would then point the finger and talk about how it's influencing content. And I don't even want that in the conversation.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm hoping someday, actually, the public funds, maybe through the University of Florida, would be possible, so you don't have to do quite so much out of your own hide, you know, and I mean your time, your personal time. But for right now, it's totally on you, and you're doing it voluntarily, and it's, you know, thanks.
Yeah, no problem. And thank you for being part of this. You know, your episodes are my favorite ones. I can't stand listening to myself. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, you sit there, oh, God, that guy, I can't, you know, listen to myself. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, whose voice is that?
No, I can't stand the way I sound on the podcast. But, you know, but it's really great to listen to you and the guests that you have on. And for me, when I listen to the final episode, it's always the second time I've heard it, because I had to glue it together in the pre-production or the post-production. Yeah. So, they're always really good. And I'm, you know, I'm excited to have you do a whole bunch more in 2018, and really excited for any listeners that want to become part of the enterprise. You know, reach out and let me know. And, you know, as Paul said before, you know, we can hold your hand through the process. And so please reach out, and we'll have a great 2018. So I guess with that, Paul, I guess we're kind of done with 2017. And but what's really great is, I think you can go back and look at this body of work. And what's really cool, and we talked about this a little bit off the air when we talked about download numbers, is we're creating a durable commodity here. If a story comes up about coffee or papayas or tomatoes. We have something in the queue that we can refer people back to say, hey, here's where this was covered. And it's kind of like we're slowly writing a web-based textbook on genetic engineering and its application, chapter by chapter, every week coming up with some new information that's becoming a durable piece of the scientific media. And and it's really becoming something, and I'm really glad you're part of it. So thank you so much for doing this with me, Paul.
A pleasure, Kevin, as always. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you to everybody who listens. And be sure to tell a friend, write a review on iTunes. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and next time we talk to you, it'll be 2018. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you then.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.